This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 13, 1969, part 2.
Because I was competitive and because I was pretty smart, I knew how to lay things out and I knew how to structure things. I knew how to write. I know how to put words together. So they had me writing and designing and drawing for everybody else. So I became, in effect, top dog. Yeah. So I did that for several years for Boy's Life magazine and for advertising for Chip Martin College Reporter, which was for the telephone company. I did it for rifle company, Savage Rifles. I did ads for Tintex dye,
air conditioners,
and just so much, really so much stuff that it was a career. I also did, outside of Johnstone and Cushing, some illustration work for the newspapers and for color. And I also met a guy that I did movie posters for. Here I am, 18 years old, going on 19, doing movie posters and illustration work. And whatever came along, I got to do. So I didn't actually do comic books until I did the syndicated strip for 3.5 years. Then I fell backward into comic books. Right. So it's my travel to comic books is a backward, back-ass travel into a medium that I thought was, at that time, inferior to all other mediums.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast. Back once again on our year-by-year journey throughout the Marvel Universe's entire publishing history. I, of course, am one member of the Sarcastic Four, Nick Duke, and we are here tonight to bring you part 2 of our discussion on all things 1969. And of course, I say we because I could not go on this fantastic journey alone. With me, as always, beginning with the West Coast connection, the manager himself, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you tonight?
You know, I'm doing pretty well, much as I was doing in the year 1969 when I turned 31. It was a good year, as I recall.
Tell me something about living in California in 69. How terrified were people of that whole Manson family drama?
Well, down south they were. You know, it was kind of like a scary thing, Beach Boys and drugs and all this kooky shit. But up here in the northern part of California, we weren't concerned with things like that. We were more worried about the impending invasion of the Grateful Dead and their caravans to our towns, and the patchouli and the crafts and all that, the Bill Walton of it all. So yeah, things were tough that year, but we pressed through and we've become a fairly prosperous state in the Union since then.
Awesome. Great to hear. And of course, when I think 69, I can't help but think another member of the Sarcastic Four, Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you tonight?
Yes, we are now covering the sexiest of years, and I enjoyed that sexy trip down memory lane by a sexy man, the manager, now owner, Todd Weber.
Oh.
Not to tell tales out of skewl. Anyway, looking forward to diving into these sexy comics with you sexy men tonight.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of sexy men, here down south with me, or nearby anyway, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you tonight?
We're in 1969, and I'm feeling all right.
That's fair. That's fair. Compared to our last selection of comics, this is definitely all right.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not going to say it's fine, but it's okay. It's all right. That's about the most compliment I think we can pay it right now, but we're about to get into that.
Indeed we are. And just to catch everybody up, we will, of course, be taking you through a selection of 4 different titles. We're going to talk tonight about some Captain America, some Captain Marvel, some Avengers, and some Uncanny X-Men. And of course, this being our final episode for 1969, we will close out the show as we do with our awards, which are by far the most prestigious awards that will be handed out on this undetermined evening. But with all that being said, why don't we just jump right in here to this discussion, guys, where we left off last time. And we're going to pick up this discussion with talking about Captain America and what was going on with him in 1969 in the Marvel Universe. Here on our reading list, we had a selection of issues. We had 113, then we skipped 114 for some reason, and then had a conclusion in 115 through 119, a five-part story involving the Red Skull. These issues are notable for a couple of reasons. 113 is on the list because it gives us an opportunity to re-engage with some Jim Steranko art. If you listen to our discussions on 1968, you know that we gave very high praise to his work as a writer and artist on Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., handing him Artist of the Year honors for 68 across the board, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. And here in 69, he had moved over to, you know, do some of the art for Captain America's solo title. Why more of this Captain America solo work is not on our reading list, I don't know. But once again, that's a common refrain here on Marvel Edge. So we'll start with there with 113 before we jump into the rest. 113, I mean, kind of like the Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff, guys, that we talked about last time. I really don't know what else you can say about it on a podcast. It's the best art in comics, in you know, at least in this project that we've seen thus far. And it's dynamic. In particular, there's one shot of a headstone, and he actually uses the headstone to do the – and has the lettering on the shadow-covered headstone, the white lettering against that black backdrop. You got a couple of great splash pages in here, some great imagery throughout. It is a little funny that you have something as like as hokey as the I'm wearing a rubber face gimmick in a Jim Steranko book that the art is anything but hokey. But, you know, you have to forgive minor sins as it relates to the writing whenever you're getting art this great. So I absolutely love the art on this one. One of the better Captain America issues we've read, in my opinion. With that being said, let's turn it over to our Captain America correspondent, the biggest fan of the four of us. Tim, what did you make here of Steranko and our little snippet we got of him on the Sentinel of Liberty?
Yeah, man. Love this issue. That aforementioned double page spread with the words kind of scripted out on the tombstone. Welcome to my Facebook profile banner image for like the past 3 years that I've never bothered to update because number one, I don't use Facebook. And number two, why mess with perfection? Because I love the story, the art. I thought 113 of Captain America was just a perfectly paced comic, if that makes any sense. Even if the story itself is not like the best thing in the world that we've read so far, just the pacing just is so expertly done. The way that, you know, the highs and lows that it puts you through, and you're wondering like, okay, is this going to get a wrap up in one issue here? And sure enough, yeah, you don't get that rushed, like, last two pages that you see sometimes when you sort of drag things out and don't plan for your conclusion the way that you should. It's just, you can tell that this was very expertly plotted by Steranko. So, I got a lot of enjoyment out of it. You also, you do have those hokey elements, like the plastic face mask that you mentioned. I guess I'll just say that I won't lay that one at Steranko's feet. I think that was a somewhat clumsy attempt to walk back what had happened at a few issues prior in this series, which was Captain America revealing his secret identity to the world. And they very quickly realized maybe that wouldn't be the best idea in terms of long-term storytelling. So we get this whole idea instead that he is faking his own death, and it's actually meant to be like faking Steve Rogers' death, although right. Cap and Steve aren't the same person, and Captain America is still running around, and yet it's a rubber Steve Rogers face mask, so you wonder how that would really work, right? It just seems like it wouldn't be that convincing, but that's what they go with, and fine, okay, fair enough. I think the way that it's sort of brushed aside and we shall never speak of this again was maybe just the best way to handle that. We just get down to business. I didn't even completely hate Rick Jones in this comic. I mean, I did, but that's always a matter of degrees. And
right.
On that sliding scale of Rick Jones' hatred, didn't think he was too annoying. annoying here. He does actually, at Cap's directive, murder about 12 Hydra agents. So that was pretty cool to see. He also get the then current Avengers lineup shown here. Did wonder what was in the canisters of knockout gas that kept Thor and Vision in particular knocked out for so long, but doesn't really matter, I guess. You know, in service of the story, rule of cool abides. And yeah, I really, really loved this one and wished we could have read, I guess it was the preceding two issues of Cap that Steranko had also done.
Now, let me ask you, as someone who has a PhD in Avengers history, here in Captain America, we see Hawkeye as Hawkeye. But by the time later on our reading list, we get to Avengers, we see Clint Barton as Goliath. So that must have happened fairly closely to here. Or was that a continuity fuck up?
I don't think it was a fuck up. That does happen pretty soon. I'm thinking the same year. We don't see it in the books that we covered for this reading list. He is not Goliath for very long, is Clint Barton. He assumes that identity for maybe a dozen issues at most, and then he goes back to being Hawkeye. But as of the time this was published, I'm sure that he just had not assumed that Goliath identity yet. And I guess we can talk about that more when we get into Avengers. Not a development that I loved. But I don't think it's a fuck up. And by the way, I only have a master's in Avengers continuity. I have a PhD in X-Men continuity.
I'm sorry. Well, you'll get to use both of those degrees in the back half of our show. You mentioned that you wish you could have read more of the Steranko stuff. Well, let's talk about somebody who did a little extracurricular activity, went above and beyond the call of duty, and read an entire year's worth of Captain America comics. Todd, how did you like this Steranko Cap that we get a snippet of here on our reading list?
Yeah, you know, 113 was fantastic, but 110 and 111 make it even better. I think reading those three and skipping 112, which is a Jack Kirby drawn album issue where kind of the world reacts to the quote unquote death disappearance of Captain America, was kind of a blip on the radar or a fill in issue or something, but boy, Steranko did a great job. And again, he had to deal with the albatross of Rick Jones as proto Neo Bucky. And
yeah, so weird.
Yeah. And as a kid, I remember that being a thing, but I don't think I'd ever read Rick Jones, who seems younger here as teen Bucky than he had in some of the other books, except for maybe Avengers. You know, he's they're keeping him perpetually 14. 12 to 14. Mm-hmm. And but he can't ruin this. These are great stories. 110 in particular tells this tremendous Hulk versus Cap slugfest. And then you get into Hydra and Madam Hydra coming in. It's really great story. And then we resulting in the sequence where Cap fakes his death. But at the time, you don't know that. And it's neat to see Steranko not inked by himself or not doing his own work, but actually Joe Sinnott, who we know best from Fantastic Four, kind of the Marvel House inker of this time, working with him. And it makes some of it look a little bit more conventional, but Steranko's panel layouts and dynamic action are still present. And we're getting a little bit more help with the backgrounds with the inks like this. So I love these. They were kind of a blind spot. I'd been hoping to read them in this project, and I was kind of perturbed seeing that only one issue was on it. But you look at through these three issues, and each one has a double page spread that just drops your jaw to the floor, like Tim was saying, the gravestone page. And each one of these has that. And boy, it's as good as probably the best Stan Lee script, I would say, that I've read, with the exception of the Silver Surfer. I loved emotion and the way the story went through, and it seems pretty contemporary for its time. So
those spreads really telegraph the climax of the story, but not in a bad way. You know, it just goes back to what I was saying about the pacing here. You just visually and artistically, visually, and just the words on the page, you know where it's going, and you're just hanging in right along with that.
And if you're reading digitally, which we are all are reading the app. They have a, especially on a tablet, they have a huge impact because you're reading either panel by panel and page by page, and here you have something that, oh wait, is it sideways? Yeah. No, it's meant to be different. It was a 2-page spread. It's, look at the amount of detail he puts. He tells a story. That one giant 2-page spread tells a huge story with all these things, these plot lines going on at the same time. You could look at this panel or this page for minutes and still catch new things. So, you know, Kirby-esque, but in the Steranko way. A little more contemporary, a little bit more slim figures, I guess. I'm trying to describe, you know, contrast Steranko's art versus Kirby's art. And, you know, Kirby would do
it's so
like
gothic.
That. Yeah, so gothic, that's a good way to say it.
Yeah, I mean, that's not something you would see. Yeah, just not something you would see Kirby do, just in terms of playing with the atmosphere in that way.
And also, three of the best Captain America covers of all time, 110, 111, and 113. Kirby did some great stuff in the 70s. You'd see some classic, iconic Captain America covers like Avengers 4, I would consider that. But these Steranko ones are iconic and beautiful, but you would expect that because Jim Steranko did all-time level covers.
There you go. Russell, we haven't heard from you yet on this Steranko issue. What did you make of it?
I'm with these guys. It was really good. I do hate that I didn't have time to go back and read the previous Steranko issues that came before this one. I do think that Steranko's art, as compared to Kirby's, shows a more like anatomically correct way of drawing his figures, especially his female figures. I think that the way he's rendered Madame Hydra is done incredibly well. Like it's just very believable. Like whenever you, and I think that's the best way to describe Steranko art and the way he draws not just this, but like his Nick Fury stuff, is it all feels very realistic. It all feels almost photorealistic at times. Like you're seeing something that you could believe is happening right in front of you. The Stan Lee script. Yep. I thought that this was really well done. I don't understand the logic behind putting the end of a story arc or the seeming end of a story arc on the reading list without including the previous two issues or two or three issues that led into it. But at least we got to see this just gorgeous, gorgeous Steranko art. And it's really a shame that he doesn't continue on the book past this, because maybe it would have helped the issues that came next. But then again, probably not.
It would have certainly helped, you know, to what degree it would have helped is up for debate. And that's actually a great way to seg over into these five issues. My Lord, five fucking issues of this.
I read six.
I did too.
I read 114 because I thought it was stupid to cut the one issue because it actually does lead right in. And honestly, 114, not that bad.
In the first half,
it's really not that bad.
Spider-Man moody kind of story, huh?
Yeah.
It's got John Romita art too.
Yeah, John Romita.
The reason I read it, I thought it was more Steranko, but it's not.
No.
But I saw John Romita and thought, okay, well, this is still worth, you know, it's one issue between how bad can it be, even if it's not essential. So to speak.
And it's fine for what it is. I mean, it picks up and you have the whole like world is dealing with the seeming death of Steve Rogers, or death of Captain America. He has to wind up going on a rescue mission for Agent 13, Sharon Carter, which all of that part I thought was done fine. Romita's art is not nearly as dynamic or like eye-catching as Steranko. And that part of the book, I thought, okay, well, Steranko would have been really great here, right up into the part where we get a giant robot, because of course we do.
robot dildo.
He has dildo hands.
He has dildos for hands.
Yes, he does. And things don't, I mean, right about that point, you're like, okay, well, this is about, you know, par for the course of 1960s Marvel Comics. We get it. Unfortunately, more involvement from annoying Rick Jones. And then we get to the part that pretty much takes me right out of this story and takes me right out of it for the rest of this story. Cap dyes his hair brown, and that is supposed to be his new disguise. Don't worry, it plays no factor in the rest of the issues.
Now, there is a really good, like, last page Red Skull reveal to 114 that I guess we shouldn't say much more about 114 since it's not on the list, but it leads right into the next story.
So I'll give you the reveal, but the follow-up, not so much. Well,
no doubt, no doubt.
But yeah, that was 114.
So you guys kind of mentioned Red Skull, and so this five-issue arc that was on the – or I guess it was technically a six-issue arc, but five of the issues were on the reading list. Is this the first time we've done an extended five-issue full – I mean, we've had – I remember Strange Tales, for example, ran like 11 issues, but those were half the book. This is five full-on 20-page stories that stretch together to tell one long story, almost like in a modern decompressed format. So that's interesting, you know, from a structural standpoint. But you also got just a fucking ridiculous story. I really don't know what other way how else to put it.
There's no other way to put it.
The Red Skull has the Cosmic Cube and can literally do whatever the fuck he wants to. And instead of just killing Steve Rogers, you know, just going to his room and getting a gun and shooting it, he fucking swaps bodies with him or swaps appearances with him, and then doesn't even think about the fact that he just wears a fucking mask. So Steve Rogers, all he has to do is take off the stupid Red Skull mask, and it just serves no purpose. So really, the only thing that he got out of this is, I'm assuming, some hot, passionate sex with Sharon Carter. Like, that didn't happen on the page. But you have to read into the, you know, read between the lines a little bit. I guess this is historically notable for the introduction of the Falcon, introducing Sam Wilson into the Marvel universe. But this is rough, man. And it's not like the art is bad per se, but the worst thing you could possibly do, you know, to make it look bad by comparison, is putting it on the reading list right next to a Steranko issue. Like, you know, John Buscema here in 115, it's fine, but it looks like complete and utter dog shit compared to the issue we just read. So, long, pretty boring, the peak of Rick Jones being an insufferable little bitch. Like, just not much here to like in Captain America 115 through 119, unless somebody is going to come to its impassioned defense. Anyone? Tim?
Okay, I will not come to its impassioned defense. I will say that as a premise, it's kind of solid. You start off with a decent enough foundation. Did not need to be five issues, certainly. And the plot just gets more and more contrived and loses you as it reaches just heights of nonsensical bullshit, the likes of which we've rarely encountered on this project. Just some of the – I was trying to, like, no-prize some of this stuff away, right? Like, the whole – okay, so we've got a Freaky Friday gimmick with the body swap. Sure, fair enough. We've seen it before with Reed and Dr. Doom, right?
Right.
And it's not often that we've seen Stan just outright dust off a plot that he's done before and just recycle it. So it's somewhat impressive that it's only here we're getting to that point where he's just sort of blatantly swiping his own ideas. But fair enough, that's what we're going to rock with, okay. To your point, though, the Red Skull wears a mask. That's canonical at this stage in the character's existence. So, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, he used the Cosmic Cube to do this. So maybe, you know, in the process of doing this whole mind swap deal, he made the mask, like, actually Captain America's face. So it's not just a mask that he can remove, right? Okay, I'll go along with that. Except two issues later, Steve Rogers has the realization while he's in the jungle, oh, the Red Skull wears a mask. I can actually just take this off and no one will know what I look like. Wish I had thought of this sooner.
You'd think you felt that right from the jump.
Oh my God. It was a real facepalm moment. It's one that you cannot hand wave that. And it goes a step further by having him use clay again in this jungle. Clay that he takes onto his face and uses as some kind of foundation to alter his appearance, which, again, I stress, no one knows what the Red Skull looks like, so it sort of doesn't matter.
And it's also an effective hair dye.
Yes, and by the way, also puts it in his hair, and it changes him from a blonde to a brunette. Wow, the magical healing properties of clay. Who knew? And this is all going down in issue 117, so we're, you know, two issues out in this five-issue story. All I had written down in my notes is, what the fuck is going on? Followed by, what is happening?
What are we doing?
What are we doing? And then you get to...
Brand, what are we doing?
You get to issue 118, and the just flip on over to page 5 and get to the last panel on that page and prepare for some out-of-context hilarity.
Some hash hilarity.
Yeah, just do it. Just go, if you're on Marvel Unlimited right now, just go Captain America 118, page 5. Go to that last panel and prepare to laugh your ass off. It's great. But to your point, though, Tim, there's this whole series, this whole bit is just an exercise in trying to put the genie back in the bottle of revealing Cap's identity. And all this follow-up story arc is doing is highlighting just how terrible of an idea that is. Just run with his identity being revealed. The secret identity is no longer necessary, but we keep pushing this idea that they all need it. I mean, and once we get into Avengers, we'll be discussing, I'll have something to say on another character whose secret identity has also become unwieldy, and they keep highlighting it within the text of the story. But yeah, that's where we are. But I guess this is historically significant because it is the introduction of Sam Wilson, the Falcon, who honestly doesn't have that much of a personality, honestly, in these first few issues. But what an unfortunate story for him to be introduced in.
I would agree. You know, you called out a hilarious panel from 118. That's not even my favorite panel for 118. If you go over to page 12, you will get the 1969 version of animated Wolverine crying over the photo of Jean Grey as Rick Jones cries over his fucking autographed photo of Captain America because Cap has broken up with him and he can't handle the breakup very well. Like, he is the Rick Jones stuff in these five issues was, it's the worst this character has ever been, and that's saying something. Now, like,
hang on, I will say that
he does catch a backhand at one point, which was a great panel.
He catches a great backhand. He also in what was it? I think 115. One of the highlights of this arc that's really full of lowlights is. He's bothering Sharon Carter at her job, and she promptly tells him to basically fuck off, stop bothering me. I don't have time to deal with you, child. Which was a nice characterization, a nice moment for her, and putting him in his rightful place as well. Something else I wanted to mention is that issue 115 has some sort of interesting warped visual landscapes with the Red Skull kind of putting Cap through his paces as he's, you know, showing off his prowess with this cosmic cube. They're inventive enough, but here again, it makes you just long for Steranko, right? Like, why isn't he drawing a sequence like this? Just imagine that in his hands versus, you know, nothing against John Buscema, but it's somewhat workmanlike, I guess, and this was all just sort of downhill from there. So, Yeah, we're hurting for some more Steranko cap, and I don't think this arc would compare favorably to a lot of things, but especially in the shadow of what came before it. It's a rough going.
It makes you feel like the last arc wasn't even written by the same person. But it doesn't flow the same. The dialogue feels completely different. It's almost like, you know, was it Stan Lee that was credited as writer on the previous arc with Steranko just drawing it? Mm-hmm. Because it kind of feels like maybe that was actually Steranko writing it too.
That's often been a rumor of that time frame, is that the artists were far more heavily involved in the writing than they were often given credit for. So it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Let's see. I'm going to pull it up now, actually. I just want to see how, not that the credits mean a great deal.
It doesn't have a traditional credit in the book, which is interesting.
Doesn't.
It just has a listing of names, not their roles in working on the comic.
Because Stan's name was always on these things, even if he was, you know, just the editor.
Right. It must also be noted in 115 that in case Rick Jones wasn't useless enough for you, we got a brief reappearance of the fucking Teen Brigade in one panel. Because if the Avengers can't find Captain America, we'll call in these useless fucks to get the job done. Todd, you haven't had a chance to weigh in on Captain America 115 through 119, or 114 through 119 if you're feeling extra, which I was not. What did you make of this train wreck of a story?
Oh, pardon me. I'm busy writing my Exiles fan fiction right now. This is not the greatest comic book I've ever read.
Oh Lord!
I would like a refund on my Marvel Unlimited subscription. So this is insulting to my intelligence, my very being. What a terrible, terrible stretch to go from the highest of highs and then to go to this dung heap of a story. Bad art, bad story, bad plot, bad characterization, bad costume design. What is the Falcon wearing? What your bright green vest pantsuit with a swinging bird medallion and one glove for your Falcon that you just met? You stole a Falcon in Rio de Janeiro, right? That's how he met Red Wing. What is going on with Captain America? This is not good, man. I feel very, very ashamed as a comics fan having read this. So Sam Wilson deserves better. MCU certainly got him right. I do like some of the later versions of Sam as Captain America, but this is very, very humble beginnings, and Stan didn't really give us a lot to work with. I think this was a character that was retconned quite a bit over the years. He wasn't just a dude that ended up are they saying this is kind of like an island off of Argentina? Is that what they're saying?
Well, he says
Exiles. He was in Rio. I mean, that's what they're saying there. And Haiti,
I could
you're not
Haitian. Tell. Yeah,
you're from Harlem. You're not Haitian.
You sound more Harlem than Haitian. Yeah.
So maybe it is Haiti. I guess I don't know.
I don't know. Don't Haiti player, Haiti game. Terrible.
You know what else? You know what else? I just realized.
God, what else?
Well done. The best worst part of this whole story is that 119, the wrap up, suffers from the Raiders of the Lost Ark problem. And if you don't know what I mean by the Raiders of the Lost Ark problem, there's this whole like big internet criticism about how that movie, as good as it is, you don't actually need the protagonist Indiana Jones for, you know, to anything. Solve. Yeah. Like everything would have happened exactly the same way as it did, whether he's there or not.
Right.
At the end of the day. And at the end of the day here, we have MODOK of all individuals. I'm not sure whether to call him a person. But MODOK solves the problem here because he's so offended that the cube has fallen into the hands of the Red Skull that he's going to basically take that back and snatch it away from him, which he does at a somewhat crucial moment, meaning that Captain America gets to live. But I mean, it's very clear that Cap has no hope of succeeding against his arch nemesis here. Despite the Red Skull's complete lack of imagination and competence at using the ultimate power that has basically fallen into his lap, he, by all rights, should have died there. And MODOK, through no actual intent, ended up saving him, saving the day and resolving this story. Wow, that was so worth it, right?
Yeah, just to get us to that last panel that says, next, Cap goes to college. Yeah, looking forward to that one.
Yeah, having another villain save the day from off-panel is just a... It's a bizarre story choice, so I didn't really know what to make of that. But thank you for bringing it up. I meant to earlier, and it somehow slipped my mind. So,
the Gene Colan art not nearly as jarring as the Buscema and Romita. Gene Colan was maybe a little bit more suited for these last four issues. So there's that.
Right, but even so, like I was saying, you go from Steranko, and even if you hadn't had Buscema in there, to go from Steranko to Colan is still it does Colan no. favors by comparison. You know, it's just it's rough for anybody to have to follow that, and to have these all as one entry on our list is certainly a unique choice. But if you guys don't have anything else to add on Captain America in 1969, we will move forward to another captain in the Marvel universe, and that of course is Captain Marvel. And you know, if you thought after reading Captain America that the problem with those issues was that there just wasn't enough of Rick Jones being a little bitch. Boy, have we got a comic for you. Because in the pages of Captain Marvel 17, we see Rick Jones. Cap basically kicks him to the curb. Yes, I know it was the Red Skull as Cap, but I like to pretend it was actual Cap myself. Kicks the useless sack of shit Rick Jones to the curb, and he decides to mope and stew about it for half a damn issue in Captain Marvel 17 before stumbling onto these ancient nega bands that will enable him to free Captain Marvel from the negative zone. But now they're in a body shop swapping or body sharing scenario. So you've taken shitty Rick Jones with literally the only shitty aspect of early Thor comics, and you've combined them together into one easy to digest shit pill. Again, I cannot understand. Marvel in the 60s took such great pains to go right if DC was going left, or to zig when DC was zagging, to learn from what DC wasn't doing and try to not to make the mistakes or repeat some of the same tropes that they did. And yet here they are 7-8 fucking years later, still trying to beat this stupid Rick Jones character into our heads. And I've had an assful of it. I have just had an assful of it. So if you guys want to talk about Captain Marvel 17 at all, please feel free. It sucked, and it should be erased from history.
You said it, Bubba. The everything from the poor writing of Roy Thomas to the quite frankly kind of shitty art from Gil Kane. I hated this art.
Really?
I hated it.
Okay. The eyes are weird. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Like, it just takes me out of the story. Like, I mean, not that there was a good enough story here, but Jesus. Like, it feels like I'm looking at something that's akin to body horror. I'm looking at just dysmorphia. No, this does not work for me at all. I mean, I know that Gil Kane did better work than this, and this is just like bottom of the barrel for me. So no, this sucked. This sucked top to bottom. None of it was good. Even though I can appreciate a new design, a new Captain Marvel costume design, which was at least better than what we got in the previous, but everything about this was just bad. The body swap part. Oh God, do we have to? Like, Jesus, they really are trying hard to make Rick Jones a thing. Like, we couldn't make him Neo Bucky, so now we're just going to turn him into Captain Marvel. Sure, why the fuck not? Give me one more reason not to ever read this book again. So, with that, that's all I got. This sucked.
Strong, strong words from a strong man. Tim, I'm dying to hear your thoughts here.
Well, I may be letting you down because I would concur this sucked, and I have little to say about it other than I will dispute the point that Gil Kane's art was not up to par here. I mean, different strokes and all. I didn't think he was doing anything groundbreaking in this issue, but I was pretty impressed just by his basic line work. So props to Gil Kane. If anything kept me just hanging in there for this issue, it was the Gil Kane art. Story is just nothing happening, and Roy Thomas is being so extra in this script. I don't know. I've been sort of reevaluating my thoughts or what I thought about Roy Thomas and what little we've read of him thus far. And I don't know. I'm questioning some things I thought I knew, and I did not enjoy the story. I mean, the whole body switch trading places deal with the Nega Bands. Obviously, they're evoking DC's Captain Marvel here. So on the one hand, there's a winking nod to that. It's not really original, but it is sort of clever. It's really let down by two characters who are just the hole in the center of their own comic. And that's the real problem with this. I hope that changes as we progress throughout the years, and that's where I'll leave it.
Todd, your thoughts here on the new Rick Jones-led era of Captain Marvel.
Rick Jones. I ain't got no time for no Rick Jones, Hogan. Bring me Roddy Piper and Paul Mr. Wonderful Orndorff, because Rick Jones is garbage. This is terrible. I can't read this. But the art's fine. Gil Kane, this is our first exposure to Gil Kane, who was not one of Stan Lee's favorite artists. I will tell you that. Stan Lee used to say things about the way Gil Kane drew men, I'll have you know. But
did he?
He did. He did. He said, Gil, you make all the men look like they're... Well, you'll have to research it, because I will not besmirch Stan Lee any further here on Marvel Age Podcast. That would be telling tales out of school.
Thank you, Ben.
I will let... that'll be a gift for a later podcast. I will talk about Captain Marvel's new costume. Tremendous improvement on this, on the green. I do like the red, the blue, the Nega Bands. I think this is what Tim said, an intentional thing where kids of the 60s, actually kids of the 40s, were rediscovering comics. Oh, Captain Marvel, Shazam, maybe this is an updated version of it, which is funny because they're totally different companies back then. Fawcett Comics published Captain Marvel, Shazam, and here we have Marvel, who owns the trademark, the copyright of Captain Marvel, and here we're going to have Captain Marvel movies essentially released from both companies within a month of each other. It's this crazy, crazy coincidence over all the years. And then there's Alan Moore's Miracle Man, which is the best telling of this version of a story where you have a kid says the magic word and is replaced by the hero. Yeah, they're trying to make it work. They're trying to tweak things. And like my answers in these podcasts, Roy Thomas's dialogue is unnecessarily wordy, but I find that this was at least something of a quick read. I was able to get through it and go, okay, this is the status quo, mm-hmm. and let's move on to something better, because this is not great, Bob. It's just not.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a quick read because we had just seen like all the backstory in that Captain America stuff we've read. So I pretty much breezed through like the first like 10 pages that were all Rick Jones. So
yeah, well, didn't
Gil Kane work under a pseudonym? I'm sorry.
That's a maybe, but I was going to say there are two things that I found that I can enjoy about this issue now. On page 3, we do get that recap of Cap backhanding Rick Jones in much more dramatic fashion, because he goes like full arched back, tilted head. He's going to make contact with the sidewalk and everything. That's going to be great. And the other good thing is that there was only one of these issues. So there we are.
Mm-hmm. I do know pseudonym usage was very widespread during this time, Tim, if you had guys who were trying to do work for both companies. Yes. So perhaps
he did like some Submariner stuff back in when it was the split book with Hulk, Tales to Astonish.
But his style...
No, he did the Hulk stuff. He did
the Hulk stuff. So recognizable, though. I mean, people would have recognized his Green Lantern stuff. Oh, Gain is over there. He draws rib cages and backs different than other people. What can I say? You know? You recognize the way Gil Kane's lines are. If you read the DC Who's Who from the 80s, Gil Kane has about 50 entries in those, and they're all thick. But it's that Green Lantern style he was doing. Nick, you've read every issue of Green Lantern. You know a Gil Kane story when you see it, right?
Yeah, there's one panel in here, actually. Now, I need to find it because I remember reading it, and I went, oh, my God, that's just his Sinestro design. Just in a different on a different character. Maybe it was on Yon Rog. I'm trying to remember. Because if you look at it, it's the same character design down to the way the ears are shaped and the angle of the head and stuff. Yeah, his Yon Rog is almost a dead ringer for his Sinestro from like a facial structure and kind of just like the general shape of the body and stuff. It's very similar. So,
and some of the ways he does those like crackling energy blasts.
Yeah,
confused with the Kirby crackle certainly, but Scott Edward. Apparently, he did some work under that name.
As Scott Edward?
Yeah. So, anyway. I don't even have
thing was widespread until somebody we're going to talk about here in a little bit came along and just kind of said, fuck it, and worked for both companies under his real name.
Well, somebody was good enough to do that and just say, you know, you pay me, I'm the best. And he was. Mm-hmm. So, but he'll tell you that. We're going to hear a lot about that. Yon Rog, soon to be a major motion picture star.
That's right.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert for a movie that hasn't even come out yet. So there you are. Anything else we need to touch on here on either of the captains in the Marvel Universe before we take a break?
Rick Jones sucked until Peter David came along, and then he didn't suck as badly.
And when was that?
1986-7.
Good God, Todd. Good Lord. I would say the use of the name Rick Jones in Alias is probably the only time I've ever enjoyed the character, and that didn't even have the character in it, so that was good.
At least it's not Ricky Jones, you know. Let's make him a teen heartthrob named Ricky.
It would have been really bad if he had been Dick Jones, but, you know, that's neither.
That could have saved it.
I don't know. Well,
I think we've come to the conclusion that we all have about as much use for Rick Jones as Greg Phillips has for Rick Grayson.
There you go, Rick Grayson. My Lord, that's the thing that's happening.
That's a real thing.
Yeah, it sure is.
That is a thing.
Well, with all that being said, you know, Captain Marvel, we noted it was written by Roy Thomas. We had some thoughts on that. Stay tuned through the break, because when we come back, we're going to have a whole lot more Roy Thomas thoughts as we're going to delve into some Avengers and some Uncanny X-Men in 1969. Stick with us. We will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, take me back down a cool
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Marvel Age podcast. We hope you enjoyed that very informative and entertaining break from the good folks here at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. Always thrilling to hear those reads. I know they bring a tear to my eye and a twinkle to my heart each and every time I hear them. I hope you feel the same. Well, before we left you, I teased you out with a little Roy Thomas talk that we were going to delve into here in the back half of this show. And let's just dive right into that, as in 1969, we get a taste of Roy Thomas writing The Avengers. Now, last time we talked Avengers in 1968, we posed an interesting question. When do the Avengers become good? Because for the entirety of their existence on this show, they have not been to this point, with very rare single-issue blips here and there. And in 1969, we get a little look at them with a two-part Ultron story and also a Squadron Sinister issue in 67 through 68, which covers the Ultron story, and 70, which covers Squadron Sinister. We'll take the Ultron story first, because it's kind of unrelated to the Squadron Sinister, despite being listed as one injury on the reading list. But once again, what can we do about that? Here's what I'll say about it. It was the first time I think I've read Avengers for this project and not been bored to death by it. And I don't know if that's because of Roy Thomas. I don't know if it is or it isn't. I'm not really sure what it was. And I can't sit here and say that any of it was just absolutely blow away outstanding, but I thought it started to finally hit that baseline of at least being okay. Like, it started to finally show a little bit of appeal here in the concept. So I don't know. I was ultimately, it kind of worked for me. You got Roy Thomas here. You got, I think Barry, is it Barry Windsor-Smith, Todd? You'll know.
Yeah. He is early form, his first form. This is not Weapon X, Barry Windsor-Smith.
Right. And again, none of it is great, but I think it is starting to trend upward finally, where it's just been dead on arrival for me for the bulk of its existence. I don't know. Maybe I'm out here on an island. I know, Tim, you have teased us with complex Avengers feelings, so please delve into those here in the form of this Ultron story.
Okay. Well, I think they will be two-part complex Avengers feelings, because let's take Avengers 67 and 68 first, which is the Ultron story. We asked the question in an earlier episode, when does Avengers get good? I think I also posed the question, when does Roy Thomas get good? And it kind of hurts my heart to have to say that. I would agree with you, Nick, that this was not actively boring, but wow, did it ever not knock my socks off, if that is a thing. I mean, it's an Ultron story. You think that the great Avengers epics and great Avengers villains, Ultron is your number one or number two, by my reckoning. And this just kind of failed to get it done. And started thinking to myself in the course of reading this, boy, Ultron just kind of sucks, maybe. Wow. Yeah, I know. And I was kind of going through the mental inventory of good Ultron stories, and I think the bad kind of outweighs the good. And I'm not sure I knew that I felt that way, or even actually felt that way before going through this. And this little two-parter made me confront that within myself. I think as far as genocidal robots go, the X-Men sort of do it better, sneakily enough. And I wasn't digging this. Although you do get, I guess, probably the first references to adamantium in the Marvel universe. That is pretty cool. That is Ultron's new form. However, he is like kind of attached to this weird hover chair thing, so it's sort of not the Ultron that
I thought he was
of.
The hover chair thing.
Well, yeah, he was the hover chair thing, but
that's his lower half.
Yeah, he's got no, he's he's not exactly the most ambulatory. So not really an iconic depiction of the character.
He ain't got no legs, Lieutenant.
Not to be ableist on this podcast, but speaking of iconic, this was not the Barry Windsor Smith that I signed up for. No, sir. I would like to send this back. bring me my Barry Windsor Smith. This is not at all correct, because he does illustrate issue 67. Again, pains me to say it, I thought that art was particularly atrocious. Sub Don Heck. I said it. I'm sorry.
Wow.
I apologize. I don't.
No,
I
you don't. Don't want to say apologize.
It. Well, I don't like saying that about Barry Windsor Smith. We will see in the future, in the somewhat far future, the brilliant work that he does. I mean, some of the all-time work, aforementioned Weapon X.
Life, Death, 1 and 2.
Life, Death, my God. That awesome Wolverine solo story, Conan, my goodness. This is not him in that form at all. Issue 68 is by Roy Thomas and Sal Buscema. Sal, I know. Yeah, I know he's a favorite of yours, Russell.
He is my all-time favorite Spider-Man artist.
Wow. That's a statement.
What a spectacular opinion.
Exactly. Now you're getting it.
I don't dislike Sal Buscema at all.
Underrated AF.
Underrated. Yeah, underrated AF. Thank you. So that's a step up in art, which I never, like, Sal Buscema compared to Barry Windsor Smith, right? Not to have that fight to the death, but you would not expect to say, I like the Sal Buscema work better, right? But it's true here.
Barry Windsor Smith at his peak, Sal Buscema at his peak. No, I think Barry Windsor Smith is the better artist. But when it came to these stories, I actually got real excited whenever I saw that Sal, not John, was the Buscema who was going to be drawing this, because quite frankly, John Buscema way down here, Sal Buscema way up here.
John, I find, is inconsistent in a way that Sal isn't. Like, Sal is rock solid. So, very, love him or hate him, you're kind of always going to get the same artist with Sal Buscema.
I really like the way that that Sal drew Ultron. He's got that menacing robot facial expression just perfectly down, because the expression doesn't really change, but it's just the way Sal rendered it. It hits with me. I just love the way he draws faces. Like, all of the facial features that he puts into this are tremendous for me. And I mean, this isn't even Sal at his peak. This is still early Sal. I don't feel like he hits that until sometime around the early 90s.
Which is crazy. This is 1969.
Yeah. It is nuts that he's already like at this level, and he's only going to get better from here. So I'm with you on the story though. I felt like this was one of those that the idea was there. I think that as Roy Thomas was cooking this one, he just didn't leave it in the oven long enough. Should have let that one bake a little bit more and really, really think about that ending. Is that really
how
you want to leave things? Is that really how you want to cap this off, with Thor literally capping Ultron to prevent a gigantic explosion with one of the worst pieces of Deus Ex Machina I have ever seen?
Well, there was like this overwrought pathos that he was going for with the I planted the seed of one statement in his mind that overcame him. It was, thou shalt not kill. And you think, like, it goes for, like, it really goes for it, but it just lands with a thud.
I think
much better than that.
Yeah, Ultron is a homicidal robot above all else.
Yeah. You know? As I was reading that,
I was reading there was like several people around. I think they could hear me roll my eyes. I think I ought to.
Right. Yes.
Because it's just one of those that made me like put the tablet down and say, okay, I need to walk away for a second and just like really try to get back in the headspace of enjoying comics, because that right there just killed it for me. And I was like, oh God, there's more of this to go.
So major misfire on that. Like I kind of liked the fake out with Hank Pym, like being it's sort of goofy, right? He's disguised as Myron McClain, the inventor of adamantium, but they could have pulled that off if not for that. Oh, this is how I so cleverly subverted his intentions, and he was unable to cope with the humanity of the situation. Please, come on, it's old.
Yeah. Roy Thomas should stop trying to be clever and just write action scenes, because he actually did that pretty well.
Yeah, pretty decent action scenes. I did have the observation reading this that his narrative captions kind of have more wit and personality than his actual characters, at least in Avengers. I don't know if that, I don't know if I can say that about his other major book, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
And that's all I had to say about this Ultron story.
Same.
Todd, you haven't weighed in yet.
Ultron is fine. Ultron and Hank Pym stories, no good. No good at all. I will say that this was kind of the beginning of, this is the Avengers team that, or at least the style of Avengers characterization that I grew up on, that I recognized, the Roger Stern, the Steve Englehart, that kind of era. But at the end, it ends up being Hank Pym, Yellow Jacket, saves the day with his programming, kind of. And I hate Hank Pym, and they still haven't made him work. Although, you know, they retconned and developed these things that he had done in his past or his subconscious, and that turned him apparently into a redemptive character later in the 80s. And I just hated everything about him. What's the deal with Goliath? Hawkeye, the greatest archer in the world, and now he's just kind of a token big character. What's going on with that, Tim? I mean, can he at least be like Giant Man the Archer with his giant bow and arrow? That would be cool. Like,
that would be kind of cool.
Reed Richards, give him this. Well, I mean, the character grew on me a little bit, but couldn't Reed Richards give him this like unstable molecules quiver? Yeah. And it, you know?
I don't know. It's.
Why is he part, Goliath
like,
at this point?
Wasn't he like kind of having an inferiority complex or something? And then okay, by the way, we have, like you said, we've got a lot of Hank Pym going on in this, as you do in an Ultron story. No longer Ant-Man, no longer Giant-Man, no longer Goliath. He's now Yellow Jacket, the identity he would actually occupy for probably most of his history when it comes to Hank Pym's secret identities, superhero, costumed heroes, which works well enough for him. Maybe they just thought they needed another size-changing gimmick, and Hawkeye as a dude with a bow and arrow was not really cut. I don't know. I don't know the behind-the-scenes reason for this, but it's stupid. I'm glad it doesn't stick, and I wish he did still have his bow and arrow, even as a, you know, 50-foot-tall man.
Yeah, it literally could have been any character as giant person, as giant man, you know, but and
why not Captain America?
Yeah, well, why not Rick Jones? Save the character. Jesus. I'm a genius. Janet Van Dyne.
It worked for Rick Jones.
Janet Pym actually has a character here. She's kind of recognizable as the character I read in 80s Avengers. So, like I said, this is kind of the genesis of the Avengers team I recognize. Weird typo here, a weird usage thing by Roy Thomas where he's talking about, or it's Black Panther saying, "My homeland must be made safe from those who would loot its treasures. I am an Avenger, but I am also, first and foremost, a Wakanda."
A Wakanda.
A Wakanda. Are you a Wakanda? Wouldn't you like to be a Wakanda too? This is
We're
a
all
weird
a Wakanda.
Yeah. Not great. Not great, Bob.
Wakanda got to be kidding me.
Yeah, I think Thomas is developing as a writer. It's definitely a different voice than Stan Lee. You know, it doesn't feel like a Stan Lee comic to me anymore.
It's true.
You know, It's a little bit more wordy, or at least more contemporarily written, I would say. But not the best thing I've read, but for 1969, I think it's fine. I do. It's not Alan Moore, but it's not what was going on in 60s DC comics at this time.
No.
So there's that.
It's a little bit trying too hard, but there's worse things to be than that. They're not trying hard enough or at all, which I think we've also encountered.
Yeah, definitely. I guess with that, all that being said, we should probably jump over to Avengers 70. This is interesting because, you know, it's on here not necessarily because they're trying to present this entire story, because yet again on our reading list, we're dropped in the middle of another Kang the Conqueror versus Grand Master story that we had seen previously in the pages of Avengers. But this time it's notable because of the introduction of the Squadron Sinister, which would be the foundation for later the Squadron Supreme. And is notable because it is kind of an attempt by the writers of both Avengers and Justice League around this time to kind of work in a rogue crossover, to sneak a intercompany crossover underneath the bosses, their bosses' noses, without them realizing. Roy Thomas is able to do that to much, much greater effect in Avengers than Denny O'Neill was over in the pages. Or was it, I'm trying to remember, was it Denny O'Neill or was it Steve Englehart?
I think it was O'Neill. I think it was still O'Neill, but it was, you know, it was guys like Juan Gina and Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress.
Yes. You
know, those characters that were used much better in the
Excuse me. Juan who?
Juan Gina. And he was kind of like a Thor stand-in.
Juan Gina, I think.
See, I don't even have a GED in DC history, so.
There you go. Anyway, this is the Marvel side of this rogue crossover, and, you know, the story, the stupid, like, Kang the Conqueror versus Grand Master intergalactic 4D Star Trek chess game of it all is whatever, but actually getting to see these little nods to DC and, like, how they're written, for example, you know, Nighthawk, who is clearly the Batman stand-in, gets his ass kicked by Captain America. And then one of the Avengers who's watching on the view screen goes, when it comes to Cap, that Joker wins every time, you know, stuff like that. I mean, like, there was a certain, like, kitsch factor to this that I wound up enjoying. So as far as Avengers books that we've read goes, this would probably be one of the ones I've enjoyed more than most. So, yeah, kind of some praise here for Avengers 70 from me. Todd, you know a little bit more about this this history of the rogue crossover than I probably do. So why don't you talk about this one for a little bit?
Looking it up now, you know, there was characters in DC called the Assemblers. How about that?
There you go.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And they had the villains called the Extremists, but that didn't show up till the 80s. So have you ever read the Justice League International era with the Extremists? Those came from this same universe. And so this is a way of, I want to say, unauthorized crossovers, and that happened throughout the history. You know, you would see Clark Kent in a random issue of Thor or vice versa in Superman. But this was analogs of the Justice League put into the Avengers. And so we could kind of write characters or archetypes pitting our intercompany crossover. But, you know, you're not going to get Roy Thomas saying that this team is going to kick the Avengers' ass. I think that's not the point. It's just a way of presenting a thing. And they're not, I think the kids of the day might not have even gotten the joke.
Right.
You know, I think it might have been over the head. And then people eventually would say, oh, wait, this guy's got the same power. Oh, my gosh, it's so clever. It's an unspoken thing that you would eventually get when you got to be a certain level of sophistication as a reader. So I enjoyed it. It's kind of standard art by Buscema, Sal, again, but still does the job very well. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. And these characters are still being used by guys like Jason Aaron. Jason Aaron's using Squadron Supreme right now, or Squadron Sinister right now in the pages of Avengers. We also get the Black Knight.
He was in Avengers
for years and years.
Another one that I loved here is Dr. Spectrum, I believe he's called.
Yes.
And,
very Green Lantern.
The prism talking to him gives him away, actually causes him to lose the eye.
Well, the prism is a complete dick.
Well, the prism knows more than this fucking Dr. Spectrum guy, clearly. If they had made a big screen version, they would, you know, have written the prism to talk into the script and then taken it out because it's, quote, not believable enough. But that's neither here nor there. Tim?
Complicated Green Lantern 2011 feelings.
Always. That's the most complicated of feelings. Tim, what'd you make of this one?
Yeah, speaking of feelings, this is the second half of my complex Avengers feelings because I kind of love this.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. I mean, far and away, I think the best Avengers stuff that we've covered. And the reason it's complex feelings is I sort of wondered, like, I am such a mark for the Squadron Supreme, Marvel Squadron Supreme stuff, as if anyone else did Squadron Supreme, like, you know. So I was like, is this just me being that kind of mark and liking this because I want to or because it's actually good? And I will say that I do believe it overcomes the gimmick and the high concept of, hey, it's the Avengers versus four guys from the JLA, right? Because you could have done that and kept it fairly simple and contained to that, and that would have been fun, but I don't think it would have been especially memorable. And here, I think it does overcome the trappings of that gimmickry. So you've got a plot that it's just madcap hijinks, very ridiculous, but I mean, they go whole hog, so they get away with it. This whole Earth hanging in the balance, the Grand Master. So you've got cosmic scales, which you sort of want in an Avengers comic. I mean, hello, how long has it taken us to get here when they are supposedly the Earth's mightiest heroes? So living up to that mantle, finally. And as if that wasn't enough, as Todd mentioned, we get at the end of issue 70 a run-in by my all-time favorite C-lister Avengers character, causing the DQ for Goliath / Hawkeye. It's the Black Knight making his entrance to Avengers Comics. I wasn't really mentally prepared for that, so when he showed up, I was like, as much as I'm already enjoying this all in now, so, man, I would recommend reading issue 69, which is, you know, funnily enough, the first part of this. I would also recommend reading issue 70, which is, you know, the conclusion. So, I don't know. We came in on the middle. It's probably the strongest chapter, so cool, fair enough. I also need to give praise to the fucking awesome two-panel origin given for Hyperion. So it's really 2.5 panels. He comes from a microscopic subatomic, in fact, world that was destroyed by, I guess, a splitting of the atom. So, you know, that's the perversion of the Superman origin, right, with Krypton blowing up and was rescued, was an exile, if you will, a survivor of a dead world, dead planet, and just enlarged to Earth size. So how does it get much better than that? I mean, so much conveyed, so much communicated in just those two panels alone. And, you know, he's one of these four we're going to see a lot more of over the years.
And they add to them, yeah. And Grunwald kind of took over this whole concept.
Right. I mean, Nighthawk's going to stick around, Reform. The Whizzer, not to be confused with.
The Jessica Jones character, the Whizzer.
Right, yeah. That one or another wither character. He becomes what, Speed Demon, I think?
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know that anything.
Better name.
Right, I know, right? I don't know that anything really becomes of this version of Dr. Spectrum.
Oh, sadly.
Sadly, although.
Here's the prism.
Well, don't worry. We will see more of a Dr. Spectrum and a Power Prism.
I think he goes on to be the Phantom Lantern in Sam Humphrey's Green Lanterns run in 2016.
Oh, okay. We'll rock with that. But, no, I love this. And worth mentioning, the issue following this, 71, is titled Endgame.
Oh, wow.
Not on the list, but again.
Interesting. I want Henry Cavill cast as Hyperion.
Oh, how about that?
Does
he wear the metal riveted on diaper, though?
Yeah.
If you carry that out to its logical conclusion, that means Marvel will take Ezra Miller away from DC. So please let this happen, for the love of God.
To be the wizard.
Take that dead weight off of our hands over at the DC universe. But
go right on ahead.
That's neither here nor there.
So I have a question.
Anything else? Go ahead. Yeah.
Did anybody else read Grandmaster as Jeff Goldblum?
Yes,
I tried.
No. Yeah. It just didn't fit, you know, because Goldblum was pretty much just doing Goldblum, and so this doesn't even read anything like him to me, anyway.
You have to insert the stutters yourself.
You do. Right. The cadence changes quite a bit.
But I was with Tim, though. I read Avengers 69, and it started off kind of for, you know, the whole, we're going to the hospital to check up on Tony Stark, whatever. And then we get into all the Kang stuff.
Yes.
First appearance of the Grandmaster, which is why I don't understand why it wasn't included. So, again, like you guys have already kind of covered it. This was a lot of fun. I was very much in for all of this, and I really hope that we're going to get to read 71 and to continue this on, because I do really want to see where this goes. This was easily, I think, the most fun I've had reading Avengers in this whole project so far.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. With all that being said, we're going to jump over to some more Roy Thomas work on one of Marvel's prominent team books. But this time he's joined by arguably one of the more famous collaborators that we have encountered to this point in our reading project. And that is Neil Adams hopping over to the Marvel Universe to take on the uncanny X-Men here in 1969, as we get two different little two-part arcs. We get a two-parter featuring Sauron, and then we get a two-parter featuring the Savage Land and some characters known as the Mutates, I believe. So all of this was Greek to me, of course, because I have no in-depth knowledge of the X-Men continuity and what all was going on here. But I will say Neil Adams' art from the first panel is outstanding. It is remarkable. It is worthy of every accolade you could possibly throw on it. To me, it's right up there with the Steranko stuff we've seen in 68 and 69 as the absolute best art we've seen in the Marvel Universe to this point. Roy Thomas is writing, of course, here, and I think it's fine. I actually think I enjoyed these partially, in part because of the art, but I think I enjoyed these issues better than a lot of the Stan Lee written stuff that we had encountered in X-Men to this point. I was a big fan here, especially considering when I was a kid, Sauron was always a thing that I just did not understand the point of and like could not get into in the animated series or comics or what have you. So, it was interesting to see any comic make me be able to read or take in any kind of Sauron story and actually enjoy it. So, Tim, I know you've been waiting all episode to get to these. Take it away, sir, with some X-Men takes here from the Neil Adams era.
I'm just kind of tickled by the way you say Sauron.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the pronunciation is.
No, it's fine. I like it. I was very very taken with that. Our reading list says to run this back to issue 56 of X-Men if you want more Neil Adams goodness. do that. Yes, I would say required reading. Go ahead and do that. I will say this before delving into Neil Adams, the Roy Thomas script and dialogue here is much better than his somewhat stuffy Avengers work that we just covered. Particularly, you find that the characters have pretty distinctive voices, and that goes a long way in carrying us through this series, X-Men, which I would say has been awfully hit and miss, started off strong, and we haven't been exposed to a lot of it. And here we just sort of get a sense of, my, how far we've come, you know? And with Neil Adams, what can you say? There's something like a frenzied, rushed panic that just comes across in so many pages of the art from this era. Gosh, thinking back to that Barry Windsor Smith Avengers issue, like I think the problem there is that Barry Windsor Smith is not someone who's cut out to do the monthly grind. When you let him work at his own pace, he's really brilliant, but he's just not a monthly artist. And when you have someone who is not that normal, regular monthly artist on a serialized monthly book, it can really, really suffer. Not so here. His razor sharp precision, on the one hand, could make you think, well, is there a heart to it? Is there a real storytelling acumen to this? And the fact of it is, as almost photorealistic as his pencils are, to me anyway, there was like a real warmth and comfort to Neil Adams' art that came through and made this just such an easygoing reading experience. Like, you just wanted to sort of stretch out and spend some time with this, even though it is a fairly brisk, quick read. So, I mean, right away, you're struck by that. Just great pairing of art and writing. I understand Adams was doing a lot of the plotting at this point as well, so it's not all Roy Thomas as the quote-unquote writer of the book. As far as, you know, the contents themselves on this Sauron story, which is really issues 60 and 61, what can you say other than it's, I guess it's better than any story about a transformed pterodactyl dinosaur man mutate has any right to be. It's cool on the surface, but you're sort of in the back of your mind thinking this really shouldn't work. And it totally does work. As extra and as over the top as Sauron is as a villain, it sort of makes sense given the backstory that is presented to us, and given the character that Carl Lykos is here. And we kind of also get a sense of how sneaky influential Roy Thomas's somewhat heavy-handed kind of operatic scripting is going to be for X-Men comics going into the next decade. So keep an eye on that. Interpersonal dynamics as well. Real hallmark of X-Men storytelling. Get a lot of that in this little two-parter. So you sort of see how influential this stuff is going to be. And I think I'll leave it at that for these two issues at least.
Yeah, if we had gone back and reread issue 59, we might be talking about something else. How about that?
True, yes.
But yeah,
I think I know to what you're referring.
Which is
was kind of Cyclops against the Sentinels. But there was a kind of a writing assist by someone who we would, you know, I would encourage you to look at the issue and read the credits yourself and go, oh, Because he kind of learned everything he... you see the seeds of these issues in the dialogue, in the storytelling, in the characterization take flight or grow, mixing my metaphors, in about 5 years from now in the pages of Uncanny X-Men. And in fact, after Neil Adams left, there were 3 issues of X-Men before it went away and became a reprint book for years and years.
Yep. For many years.
And I don't know if that was just because Adams was gone or the book was just not selling. But I tell you what, if there was an internet in 1969, Adams and Thomas's X-Men would have broken it. Because this is the...
Yep.
This is great. I mean, Stranko, absolutely. This is right up there with it. And it was 7 consistent issues. You got the greatest hits of the X-Men with the Sentinels and Magneto in these storylines. You got the Savage Land. You got Kazar. You got the best Angel costume that there's ever been. I love that's my Angel costume. That's what he was wearing on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends in 1982. And then he wore it all through the Dark Phoenix saga. That was my Angel costume. Not the Arnold Drake one or whoever it was. Werner Roth costume that he had with the weird suspender things. This Neil Adams costume. The Neil Adams Havoc costume. Neil Adams' rendition of Polaris's costume. Everything he did on these is magnificent. The Tom Palmer inks bring out Neil Adams very well, very consistent. Tom Palmer went on to ink John Byrne's Lost X-Men issues. John Byrne kind of picked up the threads written here, you know, after X-Men 66. And back then it wasn't called Uncanny X-Men at all. It was just called Adjectiveless X-Men. And then it was given Uncanny later. But if you look it up on Marvel Unlimited, it's Uncanny.
Yeah, seven, they just kind of retroed that back to the beginning.
Yeah, Uncanny. So these 7 issues that Adams and Thomas did, although only the 3 were on our reading list because CBH reasons.
4.
I can't count. 60, 61, 62, 63.
We got one more coming up. We've got... I think 65 still awaits.
Okay, next year, in a whole different decade. Boy, Neil Adams, that mother effer can draw. I tell you what, and he was unlike Barry Smith. He was there from the very beginning. This is the first Neil Adams I've ever seen. I know he did some Brave and the Bold and some random DC stuff around this time as well. But chronologically, I think this is the earliest I had ever read. Going from him. And, you know, Neil Adams, you look at a Neil Adams page from 2010, 2015, it looks not entirely unlike Neil Adams comic art from 1969. So there's that. He had his thing. He stuck with it. Always has been a great artist and a very humble man. Let me tell you that.
I like how you did that, Todd. Russell, you haven't had a chance to weigh in here on this this Sauron story in the first 2 of these issues. What do you make here of our first exposure to Neil Adams on in the pages of X-Men?
Todd said that MF-er could draw. Back in his day at peak Neil Adams performance, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who could go like who could match toe to toe with him, and these issues are a clear example of that. He is at the peak of his game. I was just so blown away by this because I've enjoyed some of the X-Men that we've read up to this point. And thought that the artwork, you know, it's mostly good. Jack Kirby art is, you know, pretty automatic for the most part, but Neil Adams takes this book to the next level. This is right up there with that revelatory Jim Steranko moment. Whenever you see him drawing and writing Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. and those issues, like his first time, like kind of flying solo, and then you look over at what Neil Adams is doing here, and you're like, wow, Marvel, you really had the best 1-2 punch in all of comics going at that point. Just the best guys under the same roof. And my God, what a tremendous find Neil Adams really is. And I agree with Todd. I think this is the best Angel costume. I've liked several of his costumes, and for me, the 90s Archangel look is always going to be my favorite Angel look. But as far as the character pre that, this is a great costume. This is just good shit. And I'm with you, Nick, on the whole Sauron, Savage Land, all that stuff. I was introduced to that through the X-Men animated series, and it didn't do a damn thing for me. It just didn't hit with me. I never cared for it. I still don't. But reading it in this context, this particular story, seeing how Sauron really came about, which I was not aware. I was convinced that it had the Tolkien tie, that they did that on purpose, but weren't going to just blatantly say it, but they do in the issue.
Yeah, I had no idea. That was awesome.
They just went right for it. I was just like, okay, so I guess you're not afraid of the Tolkien estate suing you, so you know, go as you do. They even have the character reading Fellowship of the Ring on panel at one point, which I thought was just going to be an Easter egg and not something they were just going to blatantly call out, but they did. And it works. It all works. All of this, every bit of it. And I can't believe that they actually have a Sauron and Savage Land story that I genuinely loved. And while I didn't have time to run back to issue 56 and start with the beginning of the Neil Adams run, as soon as we are done recording here, for the first time in Marvel Age history, I am just going to pull the app right back up and go back and read all those issues tonight, because this art is that damn good. It has hooked me, and I've got to see Neil Adams drawing Sentinels, and especially having like Cyclops versus Sentinels with that kind of art. I just have to see this for myself. So, wow. X-Men was just a revelation of an experience, thanks to largely to Neil Adams' art. And I'm pretty convinced that he was heavily involved in the writing of this too. But Roy Thomas, just if I'm wrong on that, and he was the guy who was handling all those solo writing duties here, I'll take back some of those things I said. And if I were to have ever met the guy, I would have given him a candy bar, and told him that he earned it. I really hope there's a Ghostbusters fan listening to this. But anyway,
we're on this.
You never know. on this panel with me. Thank you, Tim. But there you are. This was good. Not just good. This was great stuff. I think this is like peak Silver Age comics. This has to be, because does it really get better than this?
You know what else is great?
What's that?
Is that reverse Magneto reveal.
God, that was great.
That was great. I was thinking, oh, wait, this is the awesome High Evolutionary, right? Nope.
You had to put yourself in the shoes, in the mindset of a reader at the time. We did not know what Magneto looked like. So
this is the first time we've seen him without his helmet.
Yeah. So, I mean, this truly is a reveal, not just to the characters, but to the readers as well. I mean, unless you're reading it how many years later. But that's the thing. Like, Magneto reveals, like that last page reveal had been a thing in X-Men comics up to this point. But we hadn't seen him without his helmet. So it's a reverse reveal in the sense that a character that we've been following and tracking throughout the issue all along turns out, hey, now it's Magneto, and it totally works.
You know, so, Tim, just like Tim, Zorn, that reminded worked me. Yes, Zorn was
such, oh my God, that's... Zorn is like the best one. Yeah, talk about a reverse Magneto reveal, reverse.
But Tim, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I had remembered about this big Magneto reveal, and it just completely slipped my mind that this was the moment it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that I had read about, you know, as comics history, but not something as in context, like actually reading the story as it happened. And they got me. It totally got me, because I let that slip from my mind and just took the story as was and had no idea that that's who I was looking at until that
big reveal at the end of an issue, and it was this just holy shit moment. Like, this is brilliant. This is so good.
My first X-Men comic was Giant Size, number one.
Oh, wow.
And so I grew up thinking, oh, Havoc and Polaris were like regular parts of the team before this, and mm-hmm. they were associates at best, you know? I kind of thought Havoc was a big part of the team at this point, and he was absolutely not. He was just there
for he hadn't been around for long. This. Yeah. They were kind of junior members of the team.
And what about are we to the Savage Land yet proper? Can we say anything about Kazar?
Yeah.
Kazar?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you guys kind of got into it with some of the Magneto stuff, so yeah, go right ahead.
Never really enjoyed him, but he serves his purpose here. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, he gives you a character to relate to and be their ally, their base here in the Savage Land. How come nobody else ever ends up in the Savage Land? Except for in Secret, what was it, Secret Warriors or one of the Secret Avengers stories, there was a Savage Land thing. But nobody else ever gets there but the X-Men.
It's kind of weird. It's just like when you're in Japan, you always have to run into Sunfire. When you're doing anything involving the ocean, you know, two-thirds of the Earth's mass, you have to have Namor. Yeah, if you're in Wakanda, well, that's kind of his whole gimmick is being a Wakanda, the Black Panther. But I mean, the Savage Land, it's one of those really broad concepts with, I suppose, a decent amount of potential, and it just happened to debut in X-Men Comics way back in, what, like issue 10 or so? And there's nothing inherently tying it to the X-Men mythos, and you feel that it, by this point, maybe it should have been just appropriated by the larger Marvel Universe.
Like the Hulk in the Savage Land. I could get behind that. You could do a whole year there.
Yeah, really. They've done a little bit of that, I think, but not a lot. I mean, I can recall like one story from the 90s, and beyond that, maybe none. I mean, it just doesn't get a lot of play outside of the X books for whatever reason. And so that's, I don't know, that's always been very strange to me. And I would concur that there aren't a lot of just Savage Land centric stories that I really enjoy, but this one is sort of transcendent. So, yeah.
I'm with you guys. I don't like Kazar as a character most of the time. But he's got one really kind of badass moment that I really liked in this story. I'm trying to remember which issue it was in. But there's a scene where a flautist or a Pied Piper type character, if you will, is summoning a giant lizard to attack the X-Men, and Kazar just runs off, and they think that he's abandoned them, but mm-hmm. really he's gone to find this guy who's playing the music and picks him up by his head, and I interpret this as him like snapping this guy's neck and just dropping him there on the rocks without saying a word. And I was like, this was just a badass scene. It's not going to inspire me to go and read a bunch of like Kazar comics or anything, but the use of him in this story made me feel like I don't hate seeing this guy in a book.
Yep. Same. It was just a 3-panel sequence, wordless. That it's really badass. I pop for it for sure.
I'm going to pop for that scene every time. It's just straight up. That was awesome. Can we have him do more of that? Like, don't speak too much. Just kick ass.
Awesome. Any further thoughts here on X-Men before we wrap up? Yeah, go ahead.
Comics historians will tell you that the Bronze Age officially began with the hard-traveling heroes. I say thee nay. Mm-hmm. The Bronze Age began with Neil Adams on Uncanny X-Men / X-Men issue 58. No, I'm sorry, 56. Wow. At 56.
Is that the one with the logo? Monolith.
Yeah.
The logo being manipulated?
Yes. This is so contemporary and timeless already that it doesn't read like a 1969 comic. It just doesn't. This is where things were changing. The plot line's a little bit more sophisticated. The characterization certainly so. But just graphically, holy crap, this is another level. So, and unlike Steranko, which I would say was certainly rooted in that James Bond era, this was not. This is more future forward or forward looking. And I think this to me is where the real roots of the Bronze Age, where things were changing in comics. And we certainly got a lot more Roy Thomas as his own entity, although, you know, that's debated. Whether it was Neil Adams who eventually became a guy who wrote his own comics. You see the character Lorelei at the very, very end. That was very Neil Adams' creation.
Yeah.
And
the way that Beast is sort of spotlighted here, I think he gets a lot of shine more so than some of the other characters. It's hard to put that on, you know, one or the other, but he comes across really strong, and I think just the dialogue.
Yeah, he was
that
doing
Thomas puts in sounds very, very contemporary Beast.
It was everything was amped up. Every character was plussed. You know, you developed the characters to that much more. Cyclops was that much bigger of a leader. You know, the three issues that follow this, and I know we'll talk about them in 67, are very different. But the Roy Thomas, Neil Adams, X-Men, 8 issues of state-of-the-art magic for the era. I guess it's 7 issues. I'm sorry. I did it again. No, it's 8 issues. I'm sorry. I'm looking forward to talking about these with Ben, because this is something I had always known they were good. And I've had the Marvel Visionaries trade, but reading them...
Oh.
Reading them as a one fell swoop, holy effing S, this is great. This is, like I said, this would have broken the internet. This should have been bigger at the time than it was.
I mean, I understand it was kind of controversial at the time, even without there being a comics internet. X-Men was not a huge seller, but it had its core kind of diehard fan base, and this folks were kind of digging on the fucking Arnold Drake and Don Heck Warner Roth stuff. So when this Neil Adams guy came along, they sort of peaced out. And you think, well, that would be replaced with a larger readership. And it kind of didn't happen. I think maybe it was too far ahead of its time and didn't catch on quick enough, and sort of leads to the book's somewhat swift cancellation when it was meant to be a real shot in the arm. So we will see that happen in the very next year. That's no secret.
Interesting. We will certainly get there in the year ahead. Well, with all that being said, we have reached the end of our reading list for 1969, and thus the end of our discussion for the year. We will end this discussion, as we do each and every time we wrap up a year, with our year-end awards, which of course consist of our hero, villain, writer, artist, story, and cover of the year. So where do you guys want to start? I guess we typically start with writer, because to this point, we haven't really had much of a debate. It's been Stan Lee every year of our project. Is anyone going to make a case for Roy Thomas here, or just take it for another year?
Roy Thomas is the writer of the year.
You know,
go ahead, Russell.
I'm saying I'm leaning that way too, mostly on the strength of that second Avengers story, and of course X-Men.
Now let me be the voice for Stan here in this particular debate. I feel like there may be some recency bias creeping in, and there is some forgetting of arguably the high point of the Stan and Jack Thor run, which is it was the last episode.
That is a fair point. For my money, I liked the 2-issue Amazing Spider-Man stuff from the last time too. The Crisis on Campus,
very good as well. Yes.
I think you may have just made too strong a point to ignore there. Stan Lee does have to take it for that. Even as good as those X-Men issues were, Stan Lee had more consistent output.
Yeah, for me, it's Stan and Jack. their Thor work is something I've always held in the high regard since the first time I read it. And this is, like I said, arguably, for me personally, anyway, the high point. The Thor Galactus Ego stuff is like is just like Nirvana for me. So I'm giving it to Stan Lee. Tim, we got one Roy Thomas and two Stan Lees. Where are you going to fall on this one?
Okay, I see your point on that Stan Lee Thor stuff with Galactus and Ego. Counterpoint is Captain America, which pains me to say, being the Cap fan that I am. Doesn't entirely cancel it out, but when you compare that to what Roy Thomas produced, he had kind of a so-so Avengers Ultron story.
Counterpoint to that, Roy Thomas did Captain Marvel.
One issue of Captain Marvel that was bad, but I wouldn't call it atrocious. So, you know, I mean, the best, I put my money on it as the best Avenger stuff we've read, and next level X-Men stuff, I got to give it to Roy Thomas. I, you know, again, these complex feelings where it was at first, you know, what we've read of him up to this point, I'm thinking, when does Roy Thomas get good? Well, I think the answer is 1969.
There you go. I do think this is probably the last year I can see myself giving it to Stan in 69, but I'm going to stick by Stan
soundbite
69. There you go. Let's jump over to our artist of the year, since we just did writer. This one is incredibly tough for me because I've got three candidates that I'm kind of thinking of. I'm going to go ahead and eliminate Steranko because I feel like only one issue on the reading list. So yeah. It really comes down to Neil Adams, who earlier in the episode I called all-time great, and there's no debate about that. But again, me personally, you're hitting the high watermark of some of my favorite comics of all time. So I'm going to go Jack Kirby in 69 for his work on Thor.
Man, this is a tough year because of, yeah, Kirby was so good on all of those Thor issues. Just, man, but I can't get past this. Neil Adams took X-Men to a level that I didn't think it would hit for at least a few more years in our reading. So I'm just blown away by the level of detail in it and just how smooth and like clean. And I know that Tim, you mentioned Steranko's art having that gothic feel to it. Mm-hmm. This era Neil Adams does too.
Yeah.
They've got a very similar through line running here. So it may be controversial because there's not as much of his work here, but man, I can't not do it. Neil Adams takes it for me.
Fair enough, Tim.
Here's the thing. I'm trying not to decide this too much on the basis of stuff that I read or I'm familiar with, but wasn't actually on the reading list. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we had four issues of Neil Adams' X-Men. Okay. Mm-hmm. That are all, to me, outstanding. We had one issue of Steranko Cap. I do think that if there had been more representation by Steranko on our list,
yes,
he could be a contender for this. He'd be in the conversation. But as it stands, it's kind of no contest for me. I absolutely must give it to Neil Adams. That art looks not just like contemporary comics art, but is better than a lot of contemporary comics art, and we're talking from the year 1969. So it's not as if we're going to see a ton of contributions from Neil Adams over the years. I mean, you're not going to be able to give him a consolation prize if you don't give it to him probably this year or maybe in the next. So I mean, hands down, it's got to be Neil Adams for me.
Todd?
Neil Adams came in and did eight issues of X-Men, although only four were on the reading list. Very, very consistent, very, very high level. Jack Kirby's Thor stuff was very good. Enjoyed his photo collages and just the big, yes, the stuff, especially the Ego stuff. You know, that origin of Galactus story is not that memorable to me. I'm not going to go back and seek it out. I am going to go back and reread this entire X-Men run digitally, full page, panel by panel, what have you, just because, you know, the writing is fine. The writing's quite good, but I'm not going back necessarily for the writing. I'm going back for that art and that storytelling and how exciting it is and how well it holds up. Neil Adams is my artist of the year.
There you go. All right, let's jump over to our cover of the year. I hope the first two categories provided you equal opportunity to glance through your Marvel Unlimited covers gallery. And for me, another close one, but again, we're pulling from my favorite era of Thor comics, my favorite Thor, some of my favorite Thor stories of all time. I'll go Thor 161. That's got that shot of Ego and Galactus staring, you know, having the face off with the as they shoot eye beams towards one another, and Thor is caught in the middle of this massive clash. Always have loved that color cover for Shall a God Prevail. So Thor 161 for me. Todd? Thrilling as always.
Sorry, there it is. Sorry, I had the mute button on because I was sighing heavily during your Kirby praise.
You were sighing heavily.
It's the Incredible Hulk King Size Special, the Incredible Hulk Battle Scene Humans, drawn by Jim Steranko. That's actually my favorite cover of this year.
Tim, your favorite cover of the year.
Yeah, I would agree with that Hulk annual, you know, with the logo kind of crashing down on him, something we haven't really seen before. And if I hadn't given it to that, I would have given it to a different Steranko cover, the only other Steranko cover. So get that in there. I will say that is the best cover and probably the greatest disparity between quality of cover and quality of issue.
Yes, certainly. So
that, be that as it may, Incredible Hulk annual one.
Russell.
You know, this actually was a little bit tougher than I had anticipated it being, but I think that Hulk cover is going to wind up winning it for me as well. Only other one that that came close was Captain America 113, just because I absolutely love that that Steranko cover. So it's great. But I got to give it to the to Hulk, and those guys, you guys are absolutely right. What a wide chasm there is between the quality of that cover to the quality of the pages contained within.
All right, let's hop over and do our villain of the year. This one is kind of wide open. So many different ones you can pick from. Predictably, if you listen to my other selections, I'm going to go Ego. Ego, the Living Planet, is my villain of the year for 69. I have always loved that concept. I have particularly always loved that concept as a villain for Thor in particular. And this is arguably his best usage of all time. Not really much else to say about it. I lavished it with praise in our first 1969 episode, and I continue to do so here. Ego, the Living Planet, is my villain of the year. We'll pop back over to Russell for yours.
You know, I think that's probably going to be it for me as well. Because it's just, there really weren't that many like standout villain performances in 69.
Kingpin was good. I considered Kingpin.
My other one was Kingpin. I didn't consider Red Skull for this one. But I was close on this with Kingpin. I think he was the only other one that ran even a sort of race, but Ego takes it pretty handily, I think, because he just has more representation, and his methodology just worked better for me. So Ego, Living Planet.
There you go. I wish we could count Rick Jones as a villain. If that were the case, then we would just throw him in line. Tim, okay, go right ahead.
Sort of have to decide this one by process of elimination. It's certainly not the leader. Ego, I have a hard time considering a villain just for sort of up my own ass reasons from that story. the Red Skull, he's such a bumbling and up dumbass that he's really not in the conversation either. And then what are you left with? Ultron. I mean, I'm sorry, that Ultron and that two-parter can suck my dick. That might be a bad idea, actually.
Thou shalt not kill.
Right. And so sort of between Magneto and Kingpin, I don't think we got enough Magneto exposure. So I'm going to give it to Kingpin in that Crisis on Campus story.
Good stuff. Todd.
I was leaning Kingpin as well. And I'm going to kind of rock the boat a little bit and say Madame Hydra was maybe the most memorable villain I was exposed to this year. And especially if you go back and read all three.
Yeah.
But it's not on the reading list. But the rules of the reading list, I'm still going to stick with it. Madame Hydra is my villain of the year.
There you go.
Kind of want to change my answer.
Feel free.
She's never looked better than that Stoenko rendition. I mean,
Viper. Speaking of things, I'm going to go back and read after we get done here.
Read is a loose term for
I'm
that.
I'm changing my answer.
Yes,
I changed my answer. I'll Kingpin will get his fucking consolation prize in later years. I'm sure.
Yeah, born again.
There you go. Born again. That's true. So Tim is changing over to Madame Hydra.
Yes.
Hero of the year. I don't know if you guys can see this one coming, but I'm going to go Thor as my hero of the year. It's my favorite stuff we read in 69. So that takes it. My favorite Marvel character, or at least one of them, again, in some of the best stuff that's ever been done with him. So the mighty Thor is my hero of the year for 69. Todd, back to you.
For consistency's sake, I will say Thor as well.
There you go. You finally got one right. Tim, what about you?
Eat a dick.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I got caught up in Todd's eat a dick comments.
So. I did too.
Please repeat.
We've got a lot of fellatio in this segment. Self-fellating. Thor. If you're going to give any category to him, I would say, yeah, he gets Hero of the Year. Not for up my own ass reasons. he was obviously the hero of that story and made a good showing. So, yeah, he gets it.
Russell.
The Red Skull for backhanding the ever-living shit out of Rick Jones.
That's pretty good.
All right, yeah.
Good choice.
Red cap or skull cap or whatever we want to call it.
Skull cap gets the win for every bit of that.
Yeah, that should become more popular than the Batman slapping Robin meme because it's so much more satisfying to look at for me personally anyway.
I don't know if you recall the Colonel Sanders teacher from The Waterboy getting hit in the head at one point during the movie. But that's the noise I insert when I see Rick Jones taking it.
That's good.
But for an actual hero, it's a clean sweep. It's Thor.
Yeah. Okay. Good to hear. All right, and finally, our story of the year. So for this one, we're going to stick by the reading list constraints, so you have to kind of pick something off of here. Shock of shocks to no one. For me, it's Thor 160 to 162, Galactus versus Ego. Again, the high watermark of the Stan and Jack Thor run that sadly is nearing its conclusion on our reading list, on our project. Russell, what about you? Your story of the year for 69.
X-Men 60 through 63 pretty easily because, I mean, it's inspired me to stay up tonight to read all the stuff that came before it. It's just that damn good. I'm going to wind up rereading this story tonight, too. So, yeah, easy win for X-Men this time.
Todd?
Russell said it perfect, Bubba. Uncanny X-Men / classic X-Men, original X-Men. Issues number 60 through 63.
There you go. Tim.
X-Men.
All right. Outstanding. Loquacious as always. Well, that wraps it up, guys. I hope you have enjoyed this look at 1969 in the Marvel Universe. We have finally reached the end of the decade. It feels like it's been a long trip. I don't really remember, honestly, when we started doing this podcast, but we've made great progress. And the next time we bring an episode to our listeners, we will be moving on to the 1970s. And that's something we can talk about. The reading list for 70, not to get too much into how the sausage is made, but I split these reading lists into chunks, kind of using loosely the idea of 20 issues as the absolute maximum. And 70 is actually 20 issues exactly. So if we stick to our current plan, it will be the final time we will ever try to tackle 1 year in one episode. But we may change that. We may not. I don't know. We'll discuss and figure that out. But with all that being said, I've had a blast talking with you guys. I hope those of you out there listening have had as much fun as we have recording it. But before we sign off, we'll do as we always and give everybody an opportunity to plug their shit. I, of course, am also the co-host of the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast, which, by the way, I don't know if you know this, guys, but it's a long-running weekly podcast that is episodic in nature and, you know, that whole thing. So it's been pretty good. We've enjoyed it. We're about to be in the midst of Captain Marvel month. A lot of stuff that we'll actually be talking about in the future on this podcast. So I'll get a little bit of advance, some pre-homework in. I think that's all I got going on right now. You can follow me on Twitter at NickDuke87, where I tell Ben Morris how woefully wrong he is about Hal Jordan. Lots of good stuff to be found on there. So, yeah. Tim, what about you? What you got going on? Where all can people find you and feel their and get some good aural from you?
Okay. They can get some aural, some aural vampiring from me on two other regular gigs that I have on Place to Be Nation. We being myself and Jennifer Smith, due to record another episode of Talkin' Pop, the Haffy award-winning Talkin' Pop, I should stress. You can look for a new episode of that, I would say, in the next week and some change. And Talkin' Pop has a wrestling-centric spinoff now, known as Talkin' WCW. That is on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed with myself, Jennifer Smith, and one half of the hard-traveling fanboys, a man near and dear to your heart, Nick Duke. That is Greg Phillips, who elevates us so very much on just two outings that we've had of that show so far. We'll have a third episode sometime in March, but in the meantime, be sure to check out our first episode devoted to the one and only AA Arn Anderson and our second episode on the American Dream Dusty Rhodes. So that is Talking WCW, a new podcast that I've had so much fun recording with Jenny and Greg. On Twitter, you can find me at Psyche68, Cyke68, where I give Ben Morris shit about his WCW facts and knowledge.
Man, there's a trend developing here. Russell, what do you got going on? Where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Russell_Sellers, where I don't really harass Ben Morris at all, but I do observe his stuff. And you can also hear me on my limited series, DC Post-Crisis Management. An episode of that dropped just recently with one of the members of this here Sarcastic Four, where Nick Duke joined me to talk about his favorite event ever, Final Crisis. Yes.
I don't recall any of that. Mm.
The Dream does remember this. he had a great time hitting
me. Clearly, this is something you hallucinated during a drug-addled fever dream.
It wasn't drug-addled. You hit me over the head with an omnibus.
I hit you over the head with a copy of a Sequart book explaining the greatness behind an extended run on Batman. Get your facts straight.
I thought it was a cat statue.
Perhaps
Sauron hypnotized you.
Fucking cat statue is still here, by the way. God almighty.
More on this developing story.
For more on this, listen to DC Post-Crisis Management, Final Crisis, with one Nick Duke and myself. And of course, listen to the Marvel Age podcast, and eventually I'll be over on the Marvel Age Masterclass. And I just made an appearance recently on the new episode of Freak Out Drive-In with Jennifer Smith, where we talked about that 1998 alien invasion classic, The Faculty. Pretty soon, actually coming up very soon, production will begin on a new regular ongoing podcast that I'll also be doing with another member of the Sarcastic Four, Mr. Todd Weber. So you guys just be on the lookout for that one, as more information will be coming up later.
Awesome. Todd, you're where can people find you? What you got going on now that you have moved up to the role of owner?
I own this feed.
Pardon?
I don't know how that happened. I did not ask for this. It just happened.
You are undoubtedly the Robert Kraft of Place to Be Nation Pop.
Oh. I hope there's a happy ending to this story. we will. That was a cheap joke. We will find me on Twitter under Todd Weber, at Todd Weber Guitar, where you will hear me or see me not talk to Ben Morse in any capacity whatsoever, unless we're doing a show together. Because out of respect, our feeds tend to, you know, be very discreet, very separate. So, subscribe to Place to Be Nation Pop, help a brother out, advertise on our shows, create a GoFundMe / Patreon for our feed to help defray the costs. But do whatever you can do to get the word out about this show. And we will see you on placetobenation.com very, very soon. The site has been undergoing some maintenance and some big changes are coming. You will also hear me, speaking of Ben Morse, on the just recently released Marvel Age Masterclass for 1969 Part 1, where we talked about the Incredible Hulk and the Amazing Spider-Man and the Guardians of the Galaxy, amongst other things. And that will be up by the time you've heard this. You certainly, or see this show in the feed, gosh darn it, that show will have already been out. So that show is dropping, I believe, on February 25th. 2019, which is certainly in the past from when you're hearing this.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, guys, we hope you have enjoyed this journey through 1969 with us. Be sure to get out there and prepare for our look at 1970, just to kind of give you a heads up on what's going to be covered. We're going to be doing kind of a snapshot of all kinds of different stuff from the Marvel Universe, one or two. I think there's a couple of different things where we have like three issues, but I'm not going to read all the issue numbers because it's a long list. But just so you know, next time out, we'll be talking Iron Man, X-Men, Submariner, Thor, Hulk, Fantastic Four, Silver Surfer, Amazing Spider-Man, Avengers, and Captain America. So a giant episode for you next time if we decide to leave it unsplit. With all that being said, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. We'll see you next time. Enough said.